All right, guys, look, we know what this is. It's my pre-show pitch to try to convert more free first-hour listeners to full two-hour-plus show subscribers. And this is a format I've been using for 10 years now, so I realize that most people who see the value have already pulled the trigger on it, but now I'm trying to get deep down into those hard-to-reach places, and I guess that's you. Now, what can I say that hasn't been said? There's only a few ways a podcast works. The big one is ads. They suck, they ruin the flow of the show, and in a lot of cases, they erode the trust and respect I have for hosts that go this route. They shouldn't be promoting boner pills and hair pills or encouraging a fast track through the therapy pipeline just because they're getting paid. I've seen nutritionalists break down some of these ingredients in the Athletic health powders and drinks, and surprise, they're not as good as they claim to be. I bought a razor my favorite podcaster said would be nick-proof, nicked myself the first day. I got sucked into a foam mattress from a guy who said he's never slept better, and I haven't slept good since. And that Irish titles thing everyone was selling turned out to be a complete scam too. But enough about how my colleagues' mouths are for sale to whoever asks. I'm here to put you in this Plus membership today. 5 shows a month for $8 with a decade-long archive. And yes, the first hour is important. It's there to present our guests to the wide, counterculture, open-minded audience we've cultivated, and it gives people a feel for if they like what THC is, as well as being the proof of concept that I can do a lot more with the added time. The second hour is so I can make a living, and it's also an opportunity to get into the stuff your standard one-hour shows can't, asking guests about that obscure, provocative quote from their book that I actually read, talking about previous work they might have done, getting their thoughts on some odd subject outside of their latest material, or maybe even talking about something too spicy to be out there in the open. And that should appeal to anyone who enjoys the first hour. And when you become a Plus member, these full episodes are all there in a single 2-hour file, no switching back and forth or downloading 2 separate halves of the same interview. It's very nice to have it that way going forward, and if you want to go back, unlike most podcast archives that are just a big chronological list, thehighersidechats.com has categories and scrolling displays much like the big streaming services, and it's all optimized for mobile, and you can even download the files for offline listening. Find some old ones you liked and refresh your memory by starting at the beginning or jump in about 50 minutes to hear everything that would be new to you. I'm even going to be pulling 1 free Plus show a month out of the archive and into the free feed to give you an even better sense of what you miss. The on-site comment section is pretty lively, and the rating system is there to let me know the shows Plus people like best. You also get lifetime access to the forum and access to a bonus page of exclusive interviews I've done here and there, bonus content from other shows that I was on, videos from the few live podcasts I've done, and the MP3s of all the THC closing cover songs I've had made. But that's not all, folks. Plus members also get a discount code for THC merch, a lot of great artwork of aliens, summoning rituals, Hollow Earth maps, and a wide range of wild stuff put on shirts, coffee mugs, pillows, yada yada yada. But it's the ongoing, full interviews people want, and it's convenience that they need. Well, I know 90% of listeners are in a podcasting app right now, so at the top of the show notes, there are the sign-up links. The form is quick and easy, and THC Plus has an RSS feed like any other show, and it can be used with all the big podcasting apps too. I've got support documents and real, non-bot people to help you if you need it, but it's been made as easy as it can be, and you get a 7-day free trial to make sure I'm right. At least meet me there. I also have a Patreon link at the top of the show notes, which I don't love. I'd rather not have a middleman between us when we could be dancing cheek to cheek, but they are a Spotify partner, and a lot of people choose Spotify to listen to THC. So I wanted to make sure they could use it for Plus also, while they let us. The show notes also give you my P.O. box for cash, checks, or business-to-business bartering, as well as all the crypto addresses, because anything is better than nothing. And I want the Plus shows to be heard any way they can be. Just offer me some kind of exchange, you know? This is the job I work at. And I use this example a lot, but a waiter gets an $8 tip for walking the most forgettable meal of your life from the kitchen to the table, and you don't get anything extra for your $8 either. If what I do here isn't at least worth that, is it even worth your time? Hey, I don't like doing this part of the job, but I owe it to my family now to suck it up and make my case while I can, because who knows how long this can last. I'm not some Hollywood millionaire trying to appear genuine through a focused, grouped podcasting venture cycling through all the other celebrities in the agency. I'm just a regular guy who had to make myself valuable when the working world didn't think I had anything to offer. And I hope the first free hour proves that the full experience is worth the price. If we don't like the ad revenue-based world we're living in, then we have to support people who dare to do it a different way, who provide us something interesting, entertaining, and hopefully useful. Outside of that, I just ask that you support the guests who resonate with you, or at least let them know you appreciated what you heard. And that's it. We can get on with the show. And we'll let the rest of the podcasting world pretend there's no better way to do it than disingenuously hyping up any product that cuts them a check while we do our own thing. Meet me on the plus side, the water's fine, and enjoy.
The planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. It's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, fathom all you think you know, the less you really do. Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Yeah, where would we be without THC? The highest side chat show, Greg Carwood and Company.
Serenity now, Higher Side Chatters. From the Sunshine State, I'm Greg Carlwood. And a person will learn a lot more about reality by examining the edges rather than the consensus bubble we largely live in. And it's as if the intelligent universe gives us each just enough to start wondering about the deeper mysteries of life if we're savvy enough to pay attention to things like personal synchronicities, potent or prophetic dreams, strange sightings in the sky, telephone telepathy, occasional shifts in consciousness, or any of about a dozen things that make one go, "What was that?" And it's a curious thing to think what the world might be like if we highlighted and followed up on these strange experiences rather than pushing them to the back of our minds. Add in exotic suppressed technologies and medicine, energy, travel, and maybe even time manipulation, and you realize that our picture of reality and what's possible in it is more like a limited, illusionary box built around us that cuts out anything that doesn't fit within the worker bee lifestyle and the extraction of wealth to the top of the pyramid. Which brings me to today's returning guest, Walter Bosley, whose work always seems to fold back in some of the mystery and possibility we've been so conditioned to dismiss. Our first interview was episode 40 of the Higher Side Chats way back in 2013, where we got into his book Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom, the Arcane Science and Hermetic Engineering of the Happiest Place on Earth, that goes deep into the idea that secret knowledge about how the world really works was infused into Disneyland originally. We did the dance again in 2016, talking about the Sonora Aero Club, NIMSA, the origins of the breakaway civilization, and the Charles Delshow airship drawings that curiously have Trump written across one airship in image number 45. Walter came back in 2017 as the deeper dive into the political rise of Trump raised questions about his uncle John G. Trump being tapped to examine Tesla's research after he died, coupled with those previous curiosities about German airships. In 2019, we talked about his book, The Esoteric Napoleon, which looked at Napoleon Bonaparte's expeditions and conquests through a new lens of a man determined to learn more about our strange past and life's big mysteries. And today we're diving into some of his newest work with Todd Wood in what is being called the Lost Future series, with book titles like The Mystery of Ingersoll Lockwood and book two being The Curious Case of Margaretta Todd. If you didn't know, Walter also earned a degree in journalism and has had a 20-year career in national security and the U.S. Air Force. He's the founder of the Lost Continent Library Publishing Company and Corvos Books, and it is great to have him back. The great mystery explorer, esoteric context restorer, and chronicler of our lost future. Walter, welcome back once again. How the hell are you?
Hey, great, Greg. Thank you. It's always good to be here. And I'm looking forward to this. How you been?
Oh, I can't complain. And it is great to have you back. You cover such unique material, and I've always had a good time. Now you have two books out in the new Lost Future series. Talk to us about that name, Lost Future, and the thoughts behind it.
Well, essentially, Todd Wood and I, we have this hypothesis that in the late 19th century, every era, every time, every civilization has its influencers, as we call them today, movers and shakers, the people with the visions for where we can go, and they take us there, and they inspire us to take ourselves there. And Todd and I agree that going into the late 19th century, there was, well, a particularly elegant vision of what the 20th century could be. And we were headed in a different direction into that 20th century when it was essentially usurped and we were diverted into the 20th century that we got. So what we call the lost future is a 20th century that we should have had and could have had. And we see it as something that was taken from us. So that's what we mean by the lost future. And the two books so far go into the people whom we think were involved in the vision of what could have been, but also we try to identify those who took it where it ended up. And it's a real kind of checkered tableau, you know, heroes, villains, that kind of thing. And then that murky middle ground.
Yes, I love that idea and that description. There's a lot of researchers talking about this happening at several time depths. I mean, when you look at the ancient world and you see some of the same symbols on different continents, you're like, what is that? How could that possibly be? And a lot of those symbols speak to energy systems and this general mindset of abundance and communities of sharing. And I'm sure there's some romanticizing of the past that happens there, but still, the symbols are the symbols. And then, of course, people talk about when the network of royal families across Europe seem to arrive and they're all kind of part of the same family, second cousins once removed, uncles. And it's like, well, aren't you supposed to be French? Aren't you supposed to be German? Aren't you supposed to be British? How are you all cousins? Like, who installed you into these power positions? And then you got the Crusades and the Inquisition and just the killing of anybody who didn't go along with the program. And then, yeah, I do think so many times with guests, we're talking about the late 1800s, the early 1900s. We're looking at the robber barons. We're looking at old books that were written around that time. There was a lot of curiosity about the world, a lot of almost fantasy, but woven in a way that's like, people just wanted to have adventures and see what was out there in the world. And then, of course, the robber barons, when they come through, they're like, you know what? I know you got these cars that run on hemp and they run on alcohol. We're done with that. Cancel that. These cars run on oil because we control oil and you can't really grow it yourself or have an alcohol still. That's just one example. But across the board, it became about control and monopolizing so many things. A big part of it is the institution of the AMA. You know, the Rockefellers came in, they said, you know what, herbology, done with it. All these homeopathy, these little subtle things that seem to work, done with it. We're making our medicine from oil now. We're going to study the plants. We're going to make an oil derivative, and that's what you get. And these side effects, you know, you'll deal with them. And it's just across the board. But I love the idea of the lost future. I have a guest, Schwab, who comes on once in a while, and he always talks about trying to get back to the good timeline. And this is very much in that vein. We got to get back to the good timeline.
Yeah. And let's not forget that we were pushed also into a 20th century that would exalt and establish firmly the military-industrial complex. And that's a lot about what the 20th century that we were pushed into was about. I mean, clearly, when you look at the history of the wars, two major world wars, plus all the lesser conflicts that were really just proxy world wars, right? And to keep us in a state of agitation, to keep us at war, to keep the population nervous and worried and never settled. And it seemed like once we got into an era where things were calm and going to be settled, things had to be agitated. They had to stir us up. And I think that that's where they want to go with the 21st century. Clearly, you know, think about this. We're a quarter of the way through the 21st century already. And they started out in 2001 with the biggest example of keeping us agitated, keeping us on edge. And that, of course, was 9/11. And when you look at the political climate in the United States and increasingly around the world, it succeeded because we've been increasingly at each other's throat and divided and back and forth this tug of war. And it keeps people from being settled. And I think that one of the hallmarks of this, one of the signs you can look at, is that nowadays you have this discussion. I've been in it. I've heard people have it where when I was a kid, when I was younger, during the 70s, I was a kid, I was born in 63. In the 1970s, the 50s seemed like a different world. Fashions were distinctly different, cars, TV, everything, you know, in pop culture was distinctly different. Also, with the 60s, the 60s became as different to the 50s as the 70s were. And then again, the 80s. And it used to be that you could really see the difference between the decades. But more people have pointed out, they've noticed that, yeah, you can point to some minor differences, but there's not nearly the differences between the decades of the last three decades as there used to be before. And I think what contributes to that is this state of agitation and divisiveness that we've been manipulated psychologically through, starting with the shock of 9/11 and then the continued political shocks to us. Everything's just morphing into this one now kind of thing, because when you have distinctions in your culture, that's very much often a product of really a society having its relaxed time. Like, look at the 1950s. The 1950s weren't without their issues. We saw the rise of the civil rights movement, which needed to come and stuff. But look at the basic mood and spirit of the 1950s. It was after the war, after World War II, right? Yes, the Cold War was going on, but everybody was taking a breather, really, between the generation that fought World War II. If they weren't still in the national security game, they were all taking a breather and they were allowed to, you know, gee, nice little neighborhoods. Everybody was able to own a house and a couple of cars and buy this newfangled TV set. And, you know, they were just able to relax and breathe and enjoy their lives until 20 years after the end of World War II, when everything, you know, got agitated again, somewhat provoked by CIA and Army intel and all that stuff. And then kind of similar during the 70s and then going into the 80s. We used to get these breathers, but now it seems like they kicked off the 21st century with just no breather. It's just one crisis after another. It's one conflict after another. It's one war after another. And it looks like the same people that stole the 20th century from us are stealing the 21st.
Yeah, that's a really great summary, because my head goes right to drugs and music. What defines a decade? It's, well, they tended to be on a different drug, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the music changes. But that is what you're saying, leisure. That's what they do when they take a break. The fashion, the things when you aren't in a stress state, you can be like, how do I want to dress? What do I want to listen to? What do I want to consume to unwind? And that stuff's important. Obviously, another huge factor, obvious one, is the internet. When the internet started, it really did seem to be about, oh, now any little subculture can find other people that are into the same thing. And you can talk on message boards or find local people that are into the same thing that you couldn't do before. And now there is no really counterculture. It's just the one big culture. Everybody sees the exact same trends on Twitter and Facebook and all the apps. And you don't have to go to your buddy and say, hey, did you see that video? He already saw the video. He was shown the video the same time you were shown the video. And now all of leisure time is just sitting on the phone and scrolling. And so the music, like the drugs are obviously more dangerous than they've ever been, and they're corporatized. So yeah, it's a sad state of things, but I do love this idea of a lost future. A big part of it that is in this Ingersoll Lockwood book is predictive media and authors who might have been part of secret societies or been fed secret information and passed it off as fiction. I really love that idea. It comes up in Jules Verne's work. It comes up in the stuff about Vril and that whole thing. And there's that book, Adadorfa, that is presented as a journey inside the Earth. I love the inner Earth stuff. And I even picked up your little Hollow Earth thing, if you didn't see it here. But Walter's company just released Tales of the Hollow Earth, Edgar Rice Burroughs. It's two of his stories, At the Earth's Core and Pellucidar. I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, it's called Pellucidar.
Pellucidar. I mean, it's a made-up word, so I don't know how to say it. But it just seems like when you're talking about this lost future, a lot of it involves these prolific authors. I don't know if the information comes from societies they're attached to or intelligence networks or just their own publishers, which are sometimes the intelligence feeders for them. But talk to us about some of this predictive media. It is a big part of the Ingersoll Lockwood story, but in general, what are some good examples of it to get people thinking along these terms?
Well, I think that it depends on the writer. For instance, Jules Verne was suspected of having a link to what's called the Angelic Society, the Société d'Angélique. And that was one of those reportedly esoteric groups that had knowledge that was lost to the rest of us or hidden, and that they were feeding him ideas. Now, it varies. One argument is that they were feeding him ideas from forgotten technology of the past. You know, he wrote about submarines and going to the moon and all that stuff. And they were feeding him stuff from, say, the Vedic technologies that had been lost to us. Or the other side of it is they had some way of looking into the future. And so they were feeding him stuff that was going to happen. I think it was leaning more towards the first, and they were guiding the future by influencing these authors that had a huge public impact. So a bit of the roll of the dice if you want to have a certain impact on the future. But in Verne's case, it seemed to have worked because, you know, our rocket scientists and our aerospace scientists and our marine nautical technology guys, engineers, a lot of them in the early 20th century, mid-20th century, they grew up reading Jules Verne. Look at the development of the cell phone in this century. Several of those guys, they're like my age or older, and they were Star Trek fans. And the flip phone was literally inspired by the Star Trek communicator. So the influence of the art inspired somebody to do the very thing and make it real. And so Verne in the modern era is the first one we can really point to. Now, there, of course, was a guy like H.G. Wells, but his stuff was more of a social commentary. He didn't have the same type of impact on the future, so to speak, as Verne did in that regard. But then you have the guys who it's uncanny what they come up with, the truly predictive stuff. Now, we all like to marvel at The Simpsons and how weirdly prophetic The Simpsons, a comedy cartoon that's been around for over 30 years. You know, what the heck, you know, who are these guys? But that's what we're talking about when we talk about Ingersoll Lockwood and his particular books, the ones that seem to have predicted Donald Trump. Now, I remind people, just like I tell people that are going to read the book, you don't have to be a fan of American politics. You do not have to be a fan of Donald Trump to see why this is interesting. This guy, Ingersoll Lockwood, just like Delshow, whom you mentioned before, he obliquely, most likely, he got a glimpse. Somehow, what ended up in his writings, we don't know how he got that glimpse. But what he's got is, basically, he's got three. Two of them were about this young boy named it's a title, Baron, with one R, Baron Trump, okay? And what's interesting is the illustration of the little boy, particularly in one of the books, looks remarkably like young Baron Trump, Baron with two R's, the son of, youngest son of Donald Trump, okay? I mean, there was one particular photo of Donald Trump's son when he was running in 2016 that you can put side by side with a particular illustration in this book from 100 years before. And it looks like the illustrator was sitting there drawing young Baron Trump, but it's impossible because he was born, I think, over 100 years after the book was written. Now, of course, as you know, you've read the book, it brings into question, what did Lockwood know? What information did he have? What did he see? Because in this book, it's not just the image of the boy in the illustration that resonates with Trump. There's things that happen in Russia. There's strange events and in some cases, wild technology in weird places and things like that, that all resonate. Some of it resonates with Uncle John Trump, the guy who the FBI assigned to go look at Tesla's papers when he passed away. Well, that's Donald Trump's uncle who, you know, your audience knows about. You know, the question we ask in the book is, what did Lockwood know? How did he know it? And then with the illustration, we look at the illustrator, Charles Howard Johnson. The real question about Lockwood is more about Johnson. How did he meet Johnson? What did Johnson tell him? What did Johnson know? Because this Johnson guy is a huge mystery in himself, who has a life, what little we know about it, that resonates with time travel stories of the 1960s and 70s. So you ask, okay, the authors of those stories, Jack Finney, Richard Matheson, did they know about Charles Howard Johnson? So it inspired them to write what they wrote? Or on the wild side, did Charles Howard Johnson do the things like Finney and Matheson write about? You know, the crazy question, did he travel through time? Or more likely, did he see through time? You know, what was going on? And this was, you know, the late 19th century, that weird era when things were changing and certain ideas were coming to the forefront. It makes you wonder, was Lockwood being fed info like Byrne? Or was there some type of esoteric, arcane technology involved with literally scrying the future, so to speak? And these are the questions that we explore in the book.
Yes, and the latter is the fun one. And so I told you this before we started, but I bought The Mystery of Ingersoll Lockwood, and I didn't realize the second book in this series was out until it was too late to get delivered by Showtime. But to start with Lockwood, yes, people know about the books, but I mean, he wrote this book about little Baron Trump, a wealthy boy who lived in Trump Castle. I mean, we're getting pretty close. And the first one was called Travels and Adventures of Little Baron Trump and His Wonderful Dog Bulger. And the follow-up was Baron Trump's Marvelous Underground Journey, which invokes the Hollow Earth, which is a part of a lot of these kinds of writings that we think are somewhat predictive and interesting. And then he wrote, not part of the children's series, is my understanding, he wrote 1900 or The Last President, about citizens protesting a presidential election of a candidate from New York. You add all this together and it's clearly synchronistic with our timeline, given it was written in the 1800s. It's so much more impressive. But Ingersoll Lockwood was a lot more than just a children's author. I mean, he's a lawyer who graduated from Yale, ding, 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 and became the youngest diplomat at that time with his appointment by Abraham Lincoln as counsel of the Kingdom of Hanover. And this was interesting. Lockwood ran against McKinley, and McKinley was assassinated. So, you know, is every assassination somehow related to the competition? Not necessarily, but there's motive there. And in one of your live streams, you said, to throw a bone to the Tartaria folks, there is a portal to the inner earth over in Russia. And of course, Tartaria is often, if you look at maps, it's like in that area. But again, Russia, like It's a major thematic hit for the Trump thing, whatever it is, like the big Trump egregore. Like, you've only got a couple of things, but protesting elections, guy from New York, Trump Castle, the name Baron. It's always like with the synchromystic stuff, it's like the name, the title, but it's a thematic hit. And then the portal in Russia thing.
Well, and remember, the irony of Lockwood's last president story is that it's not really about Trump or the Trump candidate. The story is the Democrat candidate wins, and that's the beginning of the destruction of the country. So a lot of the Q folks and the Trumpers were saying, yeah, yeah, the last president, which means he'll be president. They got this. And even the people who are the Trump haters, they said, oh, he's going to destroy the country because this predicts he'll be the last president, he'll make it a dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. The irony is that that book isn't about Trump. It's about the other guy. If you read the book, William Jennings Bryan is the Democrat candidate. And think of the Bryan name. Bryan is more like Biden than Trump. But there is a place that the mob protests at on Fifth Avenue, which is real near where Trump Tower is in our times. And so it's this weird, like I'm saying, this kind of skewed scrying or glimpse that he got.
Yeah, let's get deeper into the idea of getting a glimpse. Also, I just wanted to throw this out because it came to mind. In your live stream, you said the last president comes before the first king. And there was that other major dust up where in an interview, Trump's like, I'm going to be a dictator for one day so I can do a couple of things and then I'll go right back to being president. I mean, he's clearly joking. I don't even like the guy, but I do hate when people take jokes as serious statements and then get all worked up about them. And the whole media ran with this. He said he's going to be a dictator. He told us he's going to be a dictator. And I just think it's so funny because that's another thematic hit in the zeitgeist that, you know, the last president, sure, it's the Democrat, sure, it's Biden, Bryan. Well, if that's the last president and then this is the first king or the first dictator, I mean, it's very much in the wheelhouse.
It goes back and forth.
Yes. And it's like a reflection. And this is a good segue, reflection, because let's get into this illustrator, Charles Howard Johnson, and this idea of getting a glimpse to the future. There's many ways to see the future besides a literal time machine. So let's talk about this guy, because it seems like he has a really hard to nail down history before he comes to New York. And there might even be something to be said about a divination reference in something called his Lady of Shalott and the Cracked Mirror. Talk to us about this.
Oh, boy. Yeah. For me personally, I find Charles Howard Johnson to be the hidden gem in this particular book, The Mystery of Ingersoll Lockwood, because this is the guy that's hard to explain in conventional terms. The way to start is he shows up in New York City in the 1890s, and all we know about him is what he told his colleagues, that he had spent time in Cincinnati and attended an art academy there. And he arrives in New York. He clearly has talent. He quickly earns the respect of his peers. He gets gigs illustrating in the magazines of the day and for book illustrators and such. And one of the things he illustrates is a publication of The Lady of Shalott. And in that illustration, the character is, it's kind of a Rapunzel type character, lives in a tower, is in seclusion, and her only vision to the world is a mirror, a cracked mirror. And reflective surfaces, of course, are known to be used in scrying, right? Seeing past, future, and other possibilities. And so, you know, there's the reflective surface. Now, I apply Joseph Farrell's topological metaphor, as he calls it. And in the book, we go into that. The cracked mirror, the whole mirror is the whole, okay? And the crack represents then the division in the big spectrum of reality of you have this whole, and then you have this derivative, so to speak, okay? And the crack represents the division of this amorphous division or whole. Joseph Farrell does a lot better job describing this. And here's the thing. In the metaphor, you have the common surface between these two parts of reality, okay? Now, in a spiritual, theological interpretation, which is primarily Joseph Farrell's, because he is a well-respected theologic scholar, the crack, that common surface, we are the common surface between the whole represents the creator, you know, God or whatever, the divine, let's call it the divine, okay? And then you have that division, and the other part, the smaller part on the other side of that division is the material, okay? But the common surface between the material and the divine is that crack, okay? It touches both. And we, between the material and the divine, whatever the divine is, we are the common surface. We have both the material and the divine in us. And so that's how you apply the topological metaphor there. Now, how do you apply it to what Johnson did? Well, you could consider any innate abilities human beings have, you know, in the metaphysical plane, right? Being able, we are material, but being able to touch the divine, we can. So therefore, maybe that's where our psychic abilities come from, is this other part of us that is more than just the material. And I think that that's part of what Johnson understood what Joseph Farrell calls the topological metaphor. He understood it in his own terms, because I think he illustrates it in that cracked mirror of the Lady of Shalott. Now, the cracked mirror can symbolize the possibilities. Like when you scry, when you look into that reflective surface, if there were no cracks, if it were just one pristine piece, well, that would imply you're only seeing one vision. But when you look into a cracked mirror, what do you see? Particularly if there's shards in more than one crack, you see the two different parts. Now, are they the possibilities? So does that represent, you know, when you scry, you have all these possibilities, so you just pick one. So did Johnson teach this to Lockwood? And the one that Lockwood chose, you know, whatever he was seeing reflected in the one shard, whatever he chose, happen to be the one that turns out to be accurate? I mean, are there five other authors out there who Johnson taught the same thing to, and they attempted the same kind of thing that Lockwood did, but they chose the shards that didn't come true? I mean, is that the thing? So I do think the mirror represents the possibility of looking into the future and maybe a clue as to what Johnson did, but there is another option.
Well, it's not uncommon for people with esoteric knowledge and artistic ability to fuse the two and to put symbolism in their art. And there were two things I wanted to also add to this stack. So Charles Howard Johnson, he shows up in New York. He doesn't have a history that can really be tracked very well. You can't find his grave. You're capable of doing research on old people, like people of the past, but this guy's trail runs pretty dry, and that's just interesting. But another thing he did was he illustrated a piece, a book called Evangeline, I believe is how you might pronounce it.
Yes, Evangeline.
Evangeline from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And, you know, you might think, well, so what? Well, the thing that's interesting about Longfellow is they had a family tomb. So again, all these people are super rich. You know, this guy's got a family tomb. And for some reason, they were motivated to look inside and the bodies weren't there of several of the members, right?
Yeah, what it was is they were interred into one cemetery. And in the course of, I think, after that move or during or something, when the people with the authority, with the access, went in there to do whatever they were going to do, they discovered that none of the bodies were in there. And there is apparently, as of yet, there's no known record of where, if they were moved to another cemetery, or if they were even put in there in the first place. So the bodies are missing.
Yes. And so you're painting this picture of this guy, Charles Howard Johnson. He shows up on the scene. He maybe knows a thing about a thing or two. And he's telling the people he works with maybe secrets that they actually tried to explore themselves. So coming back to Ingersoll, he obviously was a lawyer and a children's book author, and curiously also founded the Science Matinee Club that included lectures about the age and source of the moon and other interesting topics of the day. So it's clear that he was interested in kind of the esoteric sciences. I mean, science at that day is different than science today. And of that day, it was about exploration. It was about what does this stuff do? And magic was more intertwined with it. So he clearly had these interests. And he was a member of a group called the Titans. Maybe this is something like the Society Angelique, a source of knowledge about exotic technology, perhaps. Tell us about the Titans. I understand that's going to be the theme of book number 3 in the series, but it seems pretty relevant here. And maybe this is another one of these information feeding organizations that taught him to scry. I mean, who knows? Maybe there's more to connect the tissue of the idea that he could see the future, but it seems like the fruits are there. But talk to us about some of this stuff in the Titans.
Well, yeah, you pretty much described what we know of them. And Lockwood was a member. The real interesting thing is we don't know for sure if they ceased to exist. They might have simply have become an underground organization. I will say that to be a member, here's a really curious requirement to be a member. You had to be at least 6'3". It was a height requirement. And it's interesting that Donald Trump happens to be 6'3", and look how tall little Baron Trump now is. But was John Trump, the scientist who we mentioned before that the FBI sent to take a look at his Tesla secret papers and stuff, you know, there's reasons to suspect the Titans exist to this day. Were the Titans that, you know, were talked about publicly in reference to Lockwood, were they perhaps associated with this 1903 group that I have talked about and written about that was the American breakaway that just disappeared in the early 20th century? Could they be the Titans? For years, I've been wanting to do a follow-up to Latitude 33 that goes into, okay, who knew about this weird power that you could do with these carousels? Because I found multiple old carousels on Tiller Current. You know, who were the guys who were designing these things? Who were the guys that knew about this to put this there? And now, since I've learned about the Titans, this group that's into this weird knowledge and weird science, and of that era, now I feel like, okay, I might have the best lead I've ever had as to who were the mysterious carousel builders and park builders. They might have had something to do with the World's Fair's mysteries and things like that. In the information we have, they seem like just one of those dinner groups, lecture clubs that were popular back then. You know, you see the old movies and you see the gentlemen with the beards and the silk smoking jackets, and they're in the gentleman's club, which back then wasn't what it meant today. Back then it was a library, lots of wood, a globe, and they would smoke their cigars and they'd drink their brandy and scotch and they would share adventure stories. Here in Redlands, we still have what's called the Fortnight Club. Every 2 weeks they meet, and it's, you know, society men, and they would have lecturers come in on all sorts of diverse subjects. And this was very common back in the late 19th century. But this Titans group seemed to have the connections to the people that influenced the future, and particularly where technology and the weird stuff is concerned. But we know just a little more about them than we do Charles Howard Johnson. So, yes, that's going to be the Titans of the group that are going to be the focus of the third book that Todd and I are going to do in this series. So at the moment, there's not much more I can say about them with any certainty.
Well, I wonder if they wanted all their members to be 6'3 as a kind of filtering mechanism to make sure they had a little bit of that Nephilim blood still left in them.
Maybe. I mean, it is kind of a weird requirement, you know? okay, 6'3". I wouldn't make it. My son would, but, you know, I miss it by 2 inches. So, you know, Johnson, I don't recall any data where we know how tall he was. So was Johnson associated with the Titans? We don't know yet because Johnson himself is such a cipher. You know, speaking of not knowing where he's buried, you mentioned before, there's no information. We're told that Johnson dies in his apartment residence in New York, but we're not told what the dispensation of his remains are. We're not told where he's buried, what happened. He had been married to an actress, okay? Now, here's a guy who's a cipher. He goes back to the turn of the century. He falls in love with an actress. When he dies, it's in his apartment residence. And those of you who are familiar with popular time travel movies, that's very similar to the film Somewhere in Time, which was from the novel by Richard Matheson. It's the Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, 1980 time travel story. Now, Matheson was a contemporary of Jack Finney, the other writer who I mentioned. And Finney, he wrote time travel stories, a short story in which a time traveler named Charlie goes back to New York, turn of the century. And then he also wrote Time and Again, which preceded the Somewhere in Time novel by 5 years. But in that novel, it's also 1890s New York. And then in the Matheson novel, you have the character goes back in time, goes back in the case of his book, 1910, falls in love with an actress, and in the end, he dies. Now, in the novel, he goes into the novel, he's got cancer. In the movie, he dies of a broken heart. But in both cases, he's in the hotel room. Okay? So in the book, we talk about, okay, what did Matheson and Finney know about Charles Howard Johnson? Were they associated with a group like the Titans? How did they learn about Charles Howard Johnson back in the 60s and 70s? It's really the biggest mystery of this. I mean, were they writing, were they intrigued with this Johnson mystery? Or one alternative is that Johnson is from our time and did what the characters in Finney and Matheson's book do. And they travel back in time the same way through the power of human consciousness. They are able to draw themselves into the past through focus, concentration, meditation, I think connected to remote viewing, what we call remote viewing. And did we come to these things from a group like the Titans? That's one of the questions we ask. And I feel like I meandered a little bit there, but that's the nature of the information.
Yes, it's great. That must have been what you were referring to when you said you think there is another option. And then I went on a tangent and I wrote that down to come back to it. But yes, that's an interesting proposition. And Jack Finney, so just a little more context. He was a popular sci-fi author of his day. He wrote Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He wrote this time travel story called The Third Level. The man named Charlie, who slips back into time, he slips back to 1894, which is the year Charles Johnson's wife died. So that's an interesting tie-in. And I guess I have in my notes in another story, the Dakota Building is a portal for time travel, but the building wasn't built until 2 years after the story takes place. What's that about?
Yeah. And Finney admits that he took liberties because he liked the Dakota Building so much that he wanted to use it as a setting. So that was creative license on his part.
What is the Dakota Building? Is it a building in New York?
Yeah, it's the building infamously where John Lennon was murdered, shot outside. Because he had property in, I think, like half a floor in the Dakota Building he and Yoko owned at the time he was murdered. It is also the building where Rosemary's Baby is filmed. It's this old 19th century ornate structure, and you know, Finney just loved it. And so he took the liberty, the creative license to include it in his story. Now, it begs the question, you know, the fun question of Well, maybe in our timeline, it wasn't built until 2 years later. Maybe originally it was, and then through weird stuff going on in the mid to late 20th century, our timelines got screwed with. I don't know. There you're getting into some pretty wild discussions on perception and time, but
hey, that's normal around here.
Yeah. I figured you'd like that one.
Yes. So let's talk a little more about the logistics of the idea that Johnson traveled back through something close to remote viewing. Now, he was physically there. He was an illustrator of a lot of work. So are you saying this is like a level up from remote viewing, remote travel, pulling yourself into a different timeline through the veil?
Yeah. Here's what we point out in the book. It's really interesting. Finney writes, publishes his novel, Time and Again, in 1970. Now, in this novel, the guy named Cy, Sidney something, I forget the last name, goes by Cy. He is recruited by an Army intel officer who recruits him into this special unit, which uses psychics or meditation. And he's taken into this warehouse where there's all these little cubicles. And one cubicle is dressed and designed like ancient Rome. And the individual working that one is dressed, you know, like in a toga, like someone in ancient Rome. And then there's all these different eras of history. And the individual, the intelligence operative who's meditating and using the power of their mind, is living in that cubicle. And the idea is the full immersion in that era. The idea is to be able to transport your consciousness or to see back into that era, that actual time, or maybe even transport yourself. Well, this character, Cy, he picks the era of the 1890s, and he dresses like a man in the 1890s. He's surrounded by all the trappings in his cubicle, and he succeeds through the power of the mind to transport himself back in time. And of course, there's a romance and there's, you know, all the things we see where it's like, oh, hey, I'm back like, you know, 80 years or whatever. And what's interesting is we are told that through other sources that around 68 or 69 was the real early days of remote viewing research. So most commonly people think of remote viewing as starting sometime in the 70s, but there's reason to suspect that it might have started around 1968, 1969. So I asked, could Finney have learned about this, what the Army was doing? Could he have been fed this for some reason, or was this exposed to him? And he wrote about it within a fictional context, because what he describes, these cubicles and this method of, you know, looking through time, totally reminds you of remote viewing units, you know, the remote viewing unit where they're in their little thing and they have their target and they're using the power of the mind. Now, to further it, 5 years later, Richard Matheson has published his novel, which was originally titled Midtime Return, but was changed to Somewhere in Time after the movie. And his character does time travel in the same manner, exact manner, immersion. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. He goes to a place that existed. So he's in the physical space that existed. He puts on a suit from 1910, you know, the Target era. He even has the money in his pocket and, you know, all this stuff. And he, through the power of his mind, is able to transport himself physically back to the past. And these guys were contemporaries. Their novels using the same method of time travel come out within 5 years of each other. And it's in the heart of, you know, the early years of this remote viewing thing. Now, the Matheson novel doesn't involve government, anything like that. But you have to wonder, what did these authors know about what this remote viewing group possibly was doing? Now, you got that right there in the mix. So then you have to wonder, was Charles Howard Johnson a member of the remote viewing unit? Was he a member of this U.S. military intelligence group, and it actually worked? He was able to actually do it. And is he the one that told Finney about it? Did Johnson himself convince Jack Finney that that was him, the illustrator, in the 1890s? Well, oh, another part of it was, I believe, in the Finney novel, the people they send back are artists so they can draw what they see, right? So there's the illustrator connection. And by extension, did Finney introduce Johnson to Richard Matheson? Because, and finally, after years, I've convinced him to do it, Seshery and I are going to start doing episodes on my channel where we reveal the in-depth research and analysis and conversations that we have had for well over a decade on time, the nature of time, time travel possibilities. You know, part of that is a deep analysis of Richard Matheson's book and the movie Somewhere in Time. And we became convinced that Richard Matheson, the author, learned, stumbled into, deciphered, he learned something about the nature of time and the ability to see through it or move through it that he took to his grave. But it's encoded because he had a hand in writing the film. It is embedded in the novel and even more so in the film. Now, I asked his son once, hey, kind of obliquely, did your dad ever talk about blah, 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 a particular subject that is the thematic thread of what we're talking about here with this time travel knowledge? And he told me, he goes, no, I don't recall that. But, you know, I don't know if for sure whether RC would admit that to me, a nobody, you know, if his dad did tell him. But we're convinced that Matheson seriously learned something about the incredible esoteric nature of time and perhaps how human beings can see through it or move through it. So again, the question is, was Johnson one of these guys? And did Finney and Matheson meet Johnson? Did Johnson share information with these two authors that you can find in their books?
I love it a lot. I mean, clearly there's a little bit of speculation involved, but
always
the data points of, like, you know, predictive media are there. And these people are clearly in the milieu of, you know, the upper crust of their day. So I think it's very interesting. Ian Fleming, you know, that's a great example. A lot of his material comes from inside sources. They say the same about a lot of the guys who write spy novels and stuff, that they are connected to intelligence. Even Michael Crichton and some of his ideas, people say, were derived from talking to people who were involved in the actual work that he's writing about, sometimes as a hypothetical. It's like, yeah, well, the shape of this is very common. So that aspect, you know, isn't far from the truth already.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the world of spies and spy chasers and espionage. I lived in that world for a while. And, you know, people in our community, there's some people out there that they think speculation is a dirty word, because I think they have a tragic error in their general philosophy of life. Speculation is not a dirty word. Speculation is a very useful tool. And I can tell you, when you're hunting a spy, okay, very often you go into it with just one or two small pieces of evidence that tell your gut, we got a problem here. We got a mole. We got a spy. And there's a lot of throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks. Now, the definition of what sticks is when you throw that spaghetti on the wall, so to speak, basically you're pulling a thread, you're following an investigative hunch or lead, and you find real evidence to support that particular. That's how the spaghetti sticks to the wall, is you find the evidence. But in that world, when you're spy hunting, you're looking for a ghost. And that's how you have to go about it. That's why it takes years to catch these guys. Well, I look at trying to solve the mystery of Johnson just like hunting a spy. Okay, there's something funny going on here, and you have to speculate. Yeah, you pull some threads that lead to nothing. Some of your speculations, okay, that was a dead end, on to the next one. But it's a very useful tool, and you have to do it and use it. But there are people out there who have what we call a certainty fetish. And oh my God, the idea of not being certain about something scares the hell out of them. And what they do is they put in there a form of Dunning-Kruger. I call it the cocksurety thing. And they want to have cocksurety about everything. They want to be certain. They want to be certain. And so therefore, anything that's not certain, they mock. They're afraid of it. So they say, oh, it doesn't count. And what's too bad about that line of thinking is when you're dealing with cases like what we're talking about today, you got to think outside of the box. You got to be open to the speculation. You have to speculate on some things with a small s. But, you know, you have to be honest and admit when you're doing it. I try to do that. I try to say, hey, here's a hypothesis I have. I've scant evidence, but, you know, here's a possibility. And if it's possible, it has to be considered. So, yeah, you're right. You take these small data points, what little we have, and you say, okay, what are the possibilities here? You know what? We also say that it could have just been a roll of the dice. And like I said, there are 10 guys like Lockwood who wrote books, and it just so happens that the things fell into place to make Lockwood look like he was a genius with foresight, when actually he would say, what the hell are you talking about? I made all that up.
Right. Well, the cocksurian fetishizers certainly aren't listening to us now, and that's all good. But I agree. There's a lot of people where even something like 9/11, they're like, well, there was a commission. There was an investigation. So how can you doubt that? And it's like, well, if you're that easy to fool, you know, the government's got you by the balls at all times. Just like make some bullshit investigation and ease your concerns. And it works. It works on so many people. But I guess it's time we start wrapping up. I could keep you all day. I mean, it's already a marathon session at 2 hours. But there was one other thing you mentioned in your live stream with Todd, where someone from the chat said, you mean Pfizer doesn't have our best interests in mind? You said, well, they screwed me up. Hearing aids, my eyes, and arthritis too. Are you talking about a medication or something that Pfizer made?
I am talking, my friend, about the vaccine.
No.
My primary physician, my oncologist, and my rheumatologist have all independently told me you had a reaction to the vaccine. I took the Pfizer 2 shot, and within 24 hours of the second shot, my hearing reduced. It sounded like I was underwater. My whole body was racked with pain, and I started having floaters all within 24 hours of the second shot. Ultimately, I ended up with 70% loss of hearing in one ear and a little less in the other. I had to have optical surgery where I had cataracts removed and new lenses put in my eyes. And now I suffer with rheumatoid arthritis. And my rheumatologist told me, he goes, I have about 18 or 19 other patients just like you that have RA because of the vaccine. And, you know, I tried to hold off, but they said, hey, you know, you're in your late 50s, you've survived cancer, you know, you're in that zone that this thing might, COVID thing might hurt you, so it might behoove you to get it. So I finally gave in because my 88-year-old mom had it. It didn't affect her. My son took it, didn't affect him. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. And it was the second shot. And yeah, I'm one of those that it messed me up.
Wow.
And my doctors confirmed it.
Yeah, that's the rare part. You know, I'm so sorry to hear that, but I mean, it happened 24 hours after. Clearly, there's a connection, but you know, sometimes it's not so sudden. And then people go to the doctor and say, hey, I think this might have affected me because it's the only thing I've done differently. And they're like, nope, impossible. And that's adding insult to injury.
Well, I went to the emergency room after several days. My daughter says, you know what? There's fear of stroke with this. I went to the emergency room and I told them what I was going through. And they said, when did this start? And I said, it started within 24 hours after getting the second shot. You should have seen their eyes got big. And it was almost like they were robots. Oh, no, it could not possibly have been the shot. It must be something else. And they got real nervous. And I said, that's what happened. My primary physician, she was livid. She said, they didn't even test you for stroke. She goes, of course you had a reaction to this shot. You know, and the oncologists, you know, were like, yeah, looks like just like I told you. So, I'm one of those that it happens to be true, and my doctors confirmed it.
Wow. Well, I'm really sorry to hear that you were affected in such severe ways. I mean, a trifecta of ways. And I'm hearing more and more stories like that, sadly, and it's just an unfortunate situation. Weird note to end on.
I have these $3,000 Mondo Digital with Bluetooth capability hearing aids that are just amazing. They fixed my eyes. For the first time since 10th grade, I don't have to wear glasses to see distance. I only have to wear reading glasses. It's wonderful. The rheumatoid arthritis is what really sucks, I'll have to admit. That sucks, but I'm still alive.
Yeah, I mean, there are some things in the weird science realm about red light therapy and arthritis, and I'm sure you'll go down those rabbit holes, but modern technology is definitely a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Man, so before we go, tell the people about some of your upcoming work. I understand you have a werewolf project, a second volume of Esoteric Napoleon on top of the third volume in the Lost Future series. I mean, busy as ever.
Well, the werewolf book came out early last year.
Oh.
And it's just the Book of Werewolves, which is a classic reprint. The Napoleon material, I'm going to be presenting that more in documentary fashion than in a book, I've decided, because I really want to get that out there. I've made some discoveries beyond what's in the book, and I'm going to be doing audiobooks more. My books that are already written, we're going through the process. Three books have already been recorded. One of them is The Mystery of Ingersoll Lockwood. The other one is The Esoteric Napoleon in one of my pulp novels. So I'm venturing into audiobooks, venturing into documentaries. And of course, Empire of the Wheel is moving closer and closer to being a TV series. So that's always moving forward. That can be a slow process till suddenly it happens. And I got the Walter Bosley channel, which is going really well.
Man, a Walter of many trades. You got your hand in many pies. I love it.
Yeah, you got to stay busy.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, I look forward to the continuation of several of the threads that you've been on. And this has been a lot of fun. We're all over the map. It's great. Thanks for doing it and take care.
All righty. Thank you, Greg. It's always good to be here. I look forward to doing this again.
All right, cool cats and kittens. How do we feel about that one? Walter Bosley, I think he's one of the best. And I thought today was great. There are a couple of spots where you'll hear what sounds like a bad edit, but the reality is that a lot of audio hardware has a cough button on it, and Walter did press his cough button a couple of times to cough or clear his throat. And sometimes when that comes right at the end of a word or beginning of a word, it can sound like a really hard, harsh, poorly done edit, but the reality is there's nothing we can do about it. So I can't let my guy take any heat regarding that because it wasn't his fault. Just wanted to address it before the speculation came that we cut out something provocative, which we did not. So there you have it. But there's certainly some mystery around Ingersoll Lockwood and the Baron Trump books he wrote, and clearly now his illustrator, Charles Howard Johnson. You know, I don't actually think like this, but I've heard people try to build the argument that figures in history who go by three names, first, middle, and last, are signaling that they're industry plants or people placed in positions that are not exactly genuine. And I do think that's a stretch. It could have been true at one time, or it could be true on some level. But it's not like you can keep regular folks from adopting that format. We've had several guests who use their middle name as well, because there might be some famous athlete that shares their name and drowns out their search results, which I think makes sense, but it also does make me a little curious in this specific case of Charles Howard Johnson. So much weird stuff, though. The Longfellow family tomb being empty, Charles Howard Johnson not having a known gravesite or much of a verifiable history before a pretty late point in life. Ingersoll Lockwood being appointed the youngest diplomat to date by Lincoln and being this children's book author just seems weird. Like, based on what criteria are you made a diplomat? I don't know. And I'm just intrigued by the idea that Charles Howard Johnson could be a physical time traveler, seeding material from the future in his works subtly, maybe just by making little suggestions to the authors. Or maybe they were more involved in scrying, as that one detail of the cracked mirror in the painting suggests. The synchronicities are there, This is just the mental reverse engineering of how it could be that way. I could see some people saying, oh, well, you're stretching with a lot of this, but the original thread that got Walter and his co-author and a lot of people curious is the books and how synchronistic they seem to be with our timeline. Then you look at the author and you see some other odd aspects of a clearly connected person in government and in the sense of this scientific guild sort of thing. You see this illustrator doing work for another author whose family tomb is empty. You fold in some of the Margareta Todd stuff from the second hour and something really odd is going on. Clearly she was murdered for some reason. And then let's add to the stack that the aeroships are in play around this time. It's kind of like our favorite era to look at, right? Just before the robber barons monopolized everything. It seemed like a really exciting and hopeful time. Lots of esoteric technologies, lots of new inventions. The medical system had not yet been so centralized and standardized, but it's the era of Tesla. Royal Rife was alive during this time, born in 1888, died in 1971. So I like guests who focus on this time period, and I think the framing of this material as the Lost Future series is really fun. Does this all amount to an aspect of the struggle between the robber barons and those who wanted a freer, open society? Analog brought up that the Astor family wasn't just opposed to the Federal Reserve. John Jacob Astor was also into concave Earth and exploring the mysteries. He had to go for the banksters and the robber barons to create the mental construct of a fixed, controlled world where everything that is possible is known and the best technologies are in use under their steady hand, plus fractional reserve banking. So I think this is all a worthy inquiry. Walter and his co-author have dug up some unknown characters of history and found some mysterious aspects to their lives and a good chunk of predictive media, books, and illustrations. I'm into it. Over the years, I actually have seen Walter get a lot of shit online here and there. And yes, people online in comment sections tend to just be fairly negative. And I also get that some people won't like the military background or some of the personality aspects that come with that. But I like to focus on the common ground or I'd never get to talk to anybody. And Walter and I think, have a lot of that common ground. I actually think the Tartaria people need to circle back to Latitude 33 because he was on this idea of a privileged elite using the Earth grid and energetic technologies really early on. And having this stuff built into Disneyland originally is provocative as hell. We're going to suppress this stuff for the masses, but some of us might use it in very specific ways that line our pockets. I also can't believe he's been so affected by the jabs either. I mean, I can. I hear these statistics, but as an isolated case, man, ears, eyes, and joints all affected. I know a lot of people in this conspiracy space tend to get very us versus them and have a real lack of empathy for anyone who made that choice. But I don't like to see anybody suffer. And I appreciate his openness and his non-victim mentality about the whole thing. We only learn about the true fallout by those affected being honest about it. And if you lack empathy for those who faced some damage or some harsh consequences, you should think about that because you're probably a lot closer to a Fauci, Bill Gates, Klaus Schwab mindset than you should be. But I'll move on before I ruffle too many feathers with that. And I would say we can add this one to a long list of fun shows we've done with Walter. The second hour got pretty wild with the Margareta Todd stuff, the Poussin letter, the mystery of Rennes-le-Château, and Walter's personal stories from his autobiographical high strangeness memoir, Confessions of a Spooky Mind. Tons of good stuff. Become a Plus member already. The links are right at the top of your show notes. Get in the game, treat yourself to the full experience, and let's keep the THC train moving. As for the last episode with Matthew LaCroix, I was a little nervous because the early rating was low, but it ended up being a 4.5, and that's a lot more in line with my thinking. I was surprised that so many commenters felt like they got a salesman vibe or a less than genuine vibe from him. Obviously, that is a position that was very split, and several other people counterpointed that they loved it. But I find Matt LaCroix to be pretty much best in class when it comes to people focused on the ancient world. He's got good energy, a lot of passion, and he's a very good speaker. I understand why he gets so many opportunities to be on all those History Channel shows or have his own Gaia TV series. He's talented and well-informed. I think anytime we have guests who share their feelings about the future or the idea of a hidden hand of psychopathic elite through time, and these sorts of broad, overarching, this is the general shape of things as I see them, well, that's the sort of stuff that gets the strongest reactions from listeners. If you don't see the same thing as Ronnie Pontiac or Matt LaCroix on aspects of a worldview that are so fundamental, I could see that souring the whole thing for somebody. It's important to be open-minded and all that, but these are pretty foundational perspectives for a lot of us. In Matt's case, he strikes the right balance for me in saying that history is a big lie, the human story has been hijacked and suppressed, we are under the thumb of a tyrannical elite and have been for a long time, an elite that is also inspired or directed by an even higher level control system. I love all that stuff. But then he also says, you can still find a lot of good in the universe. Plug yourself into unity consciousness. We can move the needle in our favor. And the future looks pretty bright because they will fail and they will lose. I'm good with that. I think they will lose, but I just don't know if it will be soon. It could be in 500 more years, and for me, in this lifetime, thinking about how long I have left and how long my kids have left, that's functionally eternity. So chapters in the human story can be quite long, and we shall see. But I hope you liked this one and found it to be unique and interesting in a listening landscape where so much of it seems like the same five stories on 50 different podcasts. Maybe that's just me, but I'm sure you guys will let me know with the rating systems. I'm optimistic. And as for the meetups we got going on out there, let's see where we're at. HigherSideMeetups.com. If you want to see the calendar, get into the details, RSVP, or start your own event. When it comes to what's on deck, we have one tonight in Manchester, Connecticut, the crossover event with No Agenda at the Urban Brewery location in the legendary Nutmeg State. March 23rd, Red Oak Brewery in Witsit, North Carolina. Also on the 23rd, Saco, Maine, the Golden Rooster. March 30th, Abbotsford, British Columbia, Canada at Fieldhouse Brewing. April 6th, Legacy at the Riverfront, Tallahassee, Florida. April 8th, Huntington, Indiana, Heartland Harbor. And also April 8th, Carbondale, Illinois, Buckwater Brew Works. Good stuff. Go meet some new people if you're anywhere near those locations. And I appreciate you listening. If you are a Plus member, even more so. And I thank Walter for taking the time. Take care of you and yours out there. Keep the dream alive, and I'll see you soon with another one that I think you'll like too. I've done my part. Your move, esoteric technology erasers, altruistic elite assassinators, and thieves of the lost future. Your fucking move.
Well, they tie that yellow ribbon round the oak tree. They've worn out all the prayers. Sidelines, it's clear on a losing streak from the
a smoking gun in my hand. Now I'm down for the land of the free. THC, the American dream. They took that faded ribbon off the oak tree. They've worn out all the hope in their hearts. All along thought I was doing the right thing. Now I'm lying in a pool of my blood, and that's where they found me. Yeah.